Nearly 50 people have been arrested after a night of rioting in North London. Petrol bombs were thrown, vehicles and buildings set on fire.
What a big year it's been for social media. It was heralded as the great tool of democracy at the beginning of 2011, when the Arab Spring saw demonstrators take to the streets in the Middle East. But by the time rioters were texting and tweeting each other in London, it was a threat to security and democracy.
Mr. Speaker, everyone watching these horrific actions will be struck by how they were organised via social media. Free flow of information can be used for good, but it can also be used for ill. So we are working with the police, the intelligence services and industry to look at whether it would be right to stop people communicating via these websites and services when we know they are plotting violence, disorder and criminality.
British Prime Minister David Cameron. Now, were his words and sentiments there, no matter how well-intentioned, a threat to the freedom of information and interaction opened up by the digital age? That's a question that's had particular resonance in the UK since the riots. And one of those who's expressed concern is Heather Brooke, a leading freedom of information campaigner and freelance journalist, whose dogged persistence over 5 years helped expose the MP expenses scandal in Britain in 2009. She now talks about an information war developing between those who seek to use technology to organise, to challenge and to campaign, and those who seek to gather information for questionable purposes and to suppress social media and internet usage when it suits their aims. She's put her thoughts into a book called The Revolution Will Be Digitised, Dispatches from the Information War. Heather Brooke.
My investigation traces the year of 2010 because for me that was really the kind of turning point year when things started to revolutionise, when you really saw the power, the combined power of information being digitised, which means that it's much more liquid and it's harder to control, and also the interconnected web. So you have this very liquid type information and then combine that with the web and suddenly people can share it instantly across the globe, which is what you saw all around the world, where people kind of transcend old-style national boundaries and they start creating these public interest groups with fellows all around the world. And that's really where you start to see the power of the two things combining.
Now, this information war, I mean, most wars end up being very messy affairs, where sometimes it's very hard to tell, the good guys from the bad guys, where they seem to be very similar in lots of ways at times. Is the information war going to be any different? I mean, it seems to me from your writing and from your experiences that it's shaping up very much the same way.
Yeah, I think sadly it is, because what you've got is you have this incredible tool, which is what technology is. I mean, I say in the book, technology is generally amoral. It's neither good nor bad. It's how people use it. But what this technology provides us with an opportunity to do is create this amazing global democracy. But equally, it provides a one-stop shop for a nosy official, for a nosy state. And so, we as citizens in a free democracy have to decide, how are we going to allow the state to intrude on the information that is online? Are we prepared to accept state regulation of the internet? That's really what the information war is about. It's about the citizens have a right to communicate freely on the internet and to connect freely on the internet without state surveillance. Certainly there's a pushback from most authorities around the world, not just from more authoritarian states like China or Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates, but increasingly from the Western countries like Australia, Britain, Europe and America, to start saying, for your safety, we have to be able to monitor social networks. We have to be able to intercept traffic on the internet. I mean, it's not sold as, we're going to create a police state. It's sold for our safety. But what we could end up with is very much like a police state. So it is messy, and it's really about reconnecting with the fundamental core values of what a democracy is meant to be, these Enlightenment values about liberty and about what the citizens have a right to do in a country without state surveillance, without state interference.
Well, in fact, in the book you talk about governments coming together. You see a time where governments, nation states might come together to actually start to police the internet. Do you think that's actually a reality, that a government like the British government or the Australian government could join forces with far more oppressive governments to start policing the internet on a universal basis?
That's certainly a danger that people should be aware of, yeah. I mean, already a lot of police forces cooperate around the world in their cybercrime units. And it's one thing if we're talking about cybercrime, but where it becomes more dangerous is around the area of terrorism or potential terrorism. This national security rationale starts to be used by the police as a means to intrude ever more greatly into our online lives without any actual harm, but this sort of speculated harm that is conjured up and used as a means for us to hand over our liberties, really, to the state. I know in Russia, they've recently been looking at China to see how they run their internet firewalls. And I think what's even more worrying is you do have a lot of Western countries, like Australia, who are increasingly looking at ways to filter and regulate internet traffic and watch internet traffic. So even in Australia, you have a blacklist of sites, but it's secret, and so you can't tell why somebody is on there. And if you don't know who's on it, how can you appeal it? And it creates a sort of very shadowy form of censorship that is difficult to fight because you don't quite know how it exists.
Once again, we come back to that issue of the passivity of most people when they're dealing with the information age. Because, I mean, you talk about us being susceptible to arguments of an interventionist state, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, as awareness grows about the amount of information that's online, I mean, I know just recently when Facebook changed all of their settings again, there's been a kind of little campaign on Twitter. In Europe, you can make a request under the Data Protection Directive for all of the personal information that Facebook collects. And lots of people have been filing this request to see what Facebook has on you. One person made this request and they got 800 pages back. That's how much information Facebook had on this person. So it's really just like getting awareness about how much information we leave our digital footprint, and then thinking, is it right that the state has a right to interfere with that? And of course, people don't want criminals to take advantage of the internet, and nobody's saying crimes shouldn't be prosecuted. But a lot more thought needs to be had about when does the state have a right to start intercepting internet traffic, surveying it, asking for user data. And at the moment, that's still a campaign that is just getting off the ground.
But it's not just the state that you're concerned about in terms of people's data, is it? I mean, you talk about corporations and the amount of data dealing and data brokering that is going on at the moment. Just explain some of that to us.
I ended up coming across this guy, Brian Alsus, who used to work for the Obama election campaign as a data manager. And he took me through the whole business of data brokerages. And he was doing it for an election campaign, but equally, there's plenty of other people who use the same techniques. I remember he showed me this, it was called a data dictionary, and it was this 464-page book with 10,000 elements of data. Each one of those is a piece of data that you could request. You could say, I want all grandmothers who drive a Volvo and drink Diet Coke and vote Republican. And you could sort of pick along these things, and you could ask these big data brokerages for all the lists of those people and all their contact details. So all these companies are sort of harvesting those public databases and all kinds of private databases, getting them all together, data cleaning them, and then selling them on to all sorts of people who we don't know. And at the moment, we have very little control about, once we give data out, where does it go, who's it being shared with, is it even accurate, it could be inaccurate.
Heather Brook, freelance journalist and author of The Revolution Will Be Digitized, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.